Welcome to Royally Screwed. My name is Chris Shearer, and it's my honor to take you on a tour through some of history's greatest, worst, and bizarre rulers. In this episode, we're going to talk about a bizarre period of time in the Roman Empire after the death of Emperor Nero. While the Julio-Claudian saga is over, think of this as an epilogue of sorts. If you didn't listen to the last episode over Nero, then let's get things in order. Several different military leaders revolted against the emperor due to general dissatisfaction with his reign. After a while, even the Roman Senate decided it would be best to just get rid of him. Well, Nero beat them to the punch and killed himself because he didn't want the Senate to punish him. Unfortunately, Nero died without any living children or even naming an heir. The Julio-Claudians had been able to maintain a somewhat peaceful transfer of power from emperor to emperor with the naming of heirs because none of them had any sons that lived long enough. Except for Claudius, but there was a lot going on there. However, Nero had definitely thought he would live longer and wasn't really in the mood to think about who would replace him. Well, this is obviously gonna cause a massive problem. Or so it would seem. Okay, it does cause a massive problem, but not for the reason you would think when it comes to an empire needing a new ruler without a proper heir. This is all going to boil over into what is the first true civil war of the Roman Empire. Now, the Roman Republic, especially at its tail end, was all about civil wars. Heck, the empire existed solely due to a civil war. But the Julio-Claudians had been able to maintain total control, even when they were widely unpopular. The revolt against Nero isn't even considered a civil war, even though it probably should be. So, let's talk about the first civil war of the Roman Empire and the high number of men who would be put into power during this time. And you'll know that it's actually too many people because the year 69 CE in Rome is also commonly called the Year of the Four Emperors. So, without further ado, let's begin the story. We're going back in time to the Roman Empire in the year 69 CE in Too Many Cocchi in the Collina. Though the year 69 CE is the Year of the Four Emperors, we first have to go back to the previous year. In March of 68 CE, a Roman general named Vindex staged a military revolt against Emperor Nero. Nero didn't really care much about the revolt until Vindex managed to enlist the aid of the proconsul, aka governor, of Roman Spain, Servius Sulpicius Galba. Galba had served the Julio-Claudians faithfully for decades. His decision to rebel against Nero actually threw the emperor into panic mode. It especially didn't help when Galba's legions in Spain decided to proclaim him as the new emperor of Rome. Galba rejected the imperial title, but not the position itself, instead choosing to stylize his rule as General of the Senate and People of Rome. Well, a couple months and one imperial suicide later, in June of 68 CE, Galba was now pushed to the forefront as the new emperor of Rome. But let's rewind and take a look at the life of Galba up until his ascendance. The future emperor was born in December of 3 BCE. He was not related to the Julio-Claudians, at least not to any significant degree. Galba claimed that he was distantly related to Empress Livia, the wife of Emperor Augustus. However, the Sulpicii had held positions of power within the Roman Republican Empire in the past. Two distant ancestors, as well as Galba's own father and older brother, all served as consuls of Rome. And in case you haven't listened to the previous Rome episodes, a consul, one of two serving at a time for a year-long period, was the highest position of power in the Roman Republic. After the establishment of the empire, the consuls were essentially figureheads of a bygone era that were kept just to appease the system. According to the Roman historian Suetonius, when Galba finally became emperor, he was said to have created a family tree that he displayed for any of his guests to see. His father's side was reported to extend all the way back until it reached the Roman god Jupiter, their equivalent to the Greek god Zeus. On his mother's side, Galba apparently traced things back to the Cretan queen Pasiphae, the wife of King Minos. Now, in some stories, those two lions already met up with Zeus and Pasiphae, and we get the Minotaur out of that. So, I don't know what Galba was trying to achieve with this weird family tree of his. In a story almost certainly made up by Suetonius, or by the new emperor himself, when Galba was young, Emperor Augustus told him that one day he assumed the young boy would also be emperor. Apparently, Augustus' stepson and successor, Tiberius, also heard this story but decided Galba was too insignificant to take as a serious threat. That being said, when Empress Livia passed away, she left in her will that Galba was to be given 50 million sesterces, and based on some rough research, that amount is probably equal to about 200 million US dollars in 2024. When Tiberius heard about the inheritance, he slashed it to 500,000 sesterces, but then refused to pay it. Galba reached political milestones at younger ages than most other men in Rome. According to the Cursus Honorum, aka the general intended path for a young upper-class Roman man, you had to become a praetor at age 39. Galba became one at 33. He was then chosen to be the proconsul of Aquitania, aka southern and western France. In 33 CE, at the age of 36, Galba was elected as consul of Rome under the reign of Emperor Tiberius. Under Emperor Gaius Germanicus, aka Caligula, Galba was made the commander of the Roman legions in Upper Germania, where he gained even more fame and prestige. It was when Gaius Germanicus was assassinated that Galba was first tempted with the position of emperor. However, he refused to take the offer and continued serving the empire under Emperor Claudius. In the mid-40s CE, Galba was installed as the proconsul of the Roman province of Africa, which occupies the modern northern coastlines of Tunisia, Libya, and Algeria. After a couple years as the African proconsul, Galba decided he wanted to retire from politics. Funnily enough, it was Nero who forced him back into politics when Galba was made the proconsul of Hispania in 60 CE. He would obviously serve in that capacity until mid-68 CE when he joined the rebellion that would end with him as the new leader of Rome. Galba had to start his reign as emperor by making sure any dissenters and rival claimants did not get in his way. One such rival claimant was a member of the Praetorian Guard, the emperor's bodyguards, named Nymphidius Sabinus. Nymphidius had managed to turn the Praetorians against Nero, but then later would go on to claim that he was the illegitimate son of Emperor Gaius Germanicus. This story was almost certainly false, but it was what he was using to claim his potential authority. Luckily, the other Praetorians weren't having any of this and killed their fellow guardsmen. However, that's not to say that Galba's newfound status as emperor was without conflict. He decided to set out to Rome alongside another proconsul, Marcus Salvius Otho. Otho was then the governor of the province Lusitania, which corresponded to western Spain and Portugal. When they were nearing Rome, Galba's army was stopped by a group of soldiers that are historically recorded as the Legio I ad Utrix, a Roman legion stationed in Central Europe. There's been a bit of confusion over the history of this legion and who actually created it. Some sources say that Nero created the Adiotrix in order to protect the region from the various rebellions at the end of his rule. Others say that Galba actually founded the legion. A more modern consensus is that Nero got the framework together but never formalized the legion, leaving that to Galba. That's why he was able to fight this group. The battle between Galba and the future Adiotrix resulted in heavy losses but the emperor's ultimate victory. In order to secure the legion's cooperation, he ordered them to perform a decimation. Now, that word has become a bit corrupted in modern English, with people often getting the meaning wrong. A decimation was a kinda terrible order to give a Roman legion, where the members of the chosen army would have to choose one person out of every 10 soldiers and have that person killed, thereby reducing the legion's number by 1/10. Once he was finally in Rome, Galba was able to get his tenure as emperor underway. Unfortunately, he got off to a pretty bad start. He refused to pay the Praetorian Guard a significant tribute, which was a practice started by Emperor Claudius after the Guard had killed Gaius Germanicus. This was a practice that was technically not a written rule, but just done anyway in order to secure the Praetorians' support. Almost every single other emperor in the history of Rome would do this, and those that didn't, well, they wouldn't be emperor for too long. The ancient historians also write about how Galba's pick of close confidants in his imperial circle and positions of major power throughout the empire were among those considered corrupt or incompetent, or both. All in all, it shouldn't be too surprising to hear that it didn't take long for people to start rising up against the new emperor. Full-blown civil war erupted on the 1st of January of 69 CE when legions in Germania refused to swear fealty to the emperor and instead decided to name their proconsul, Aulus Vitellius, as the new Caesar of Rome. Galba decided that he would get things in order just in case everything truly went south. He decided to adopt a man named Lucius Calpurnius Piso Frugi Lucianius, try saying that five times fast, and named him as his heir. This surprised many people in the government, who assumed Galba would name Otho, the man who had fought alongside him against the Aduatrix, as his heir. Heck, even Otho was pretty confident he was gonna be chosen. This led to further trouble when Otho approached the Praetorian Guard and paid them to support him over the Emperor. Since they already hated the guy, the Praetorians sided with Otho. On the 15th of January, Galba attempted to gain the public's favor by giving a speech in the Forum of Rome. Unfortunately for him, that's when the Praetorians decided to strike. They killed both Galba and Lucius Calpurnius, leaving the throne open for contention. After just 6 months, Galba was now the shortest reigning emperor of Rome. But hey, it's only January, and we've still got 3 more emperors to go before the year ends. Unsurprisingly, since he had paid off the Praetorian Guard, Otho was named as the new emperor of Rome. Well, that didn't mean a whole lot because the empire was still in crisis mode with the rebellion of the German legions. But once again, let's hit the pause button here to actually learn more about the guy. Otho's family was said to be descended from the Etruscan princes, the Etruscans being the cultural group who ruled over most of central Italy before the Romans rose to power. His family had been in the equestrian social class before his father was made a patrician and rose to the senatorial class under Emperor Claudius. Suetonius also wrote that apparently Otho's father looked a lot like Emperor Tiberius, and this caused many people to spread rumors that he was actually the emperor's son, though this probably wasn't actually the case. It's said that Otho was a bit of a wild child and caused some problems for the people around him. He was also incredibly obsessed with his looks. Even later as the proconsul of Lusitania, he would shave all the hair off his body, including his facial hair, and sponge his skin with wet bread. For some reason. Maybe it made it softer? As a young man, Otho managed to work his way into the inner circle of Emperor Nero. The two men were relatively close as they had similar personalities, and Suetonius suggests that they may have even been sleeping with each other. Otho's life under Nero changed when he married Poppaea Sabina. Poppaea actually only married him in order to get close to Nero. Soon enough, she became Nero's mistress, and then Nero forced Otho to divorce his wife so the emperor could marry Poppaea. Around 59 CE, after the forced divorce, Nero made Otho the proconsul of Lusitania, effectively banishing him to the farthest western reaches of the empire. Obviously, this didn't sit well with Otho. When the rebellion against Nero started flaring up, he was quick to join Galba's side. And obviously, he felt that being one of Galba's first allies put him into a position to be the new emperor's successor, though we know this would not end up being the case. Once again, Otho took advantage of the feelings of unrest and paid off the Praetorian Guard. After Galba was assassinated, he approached the Senate to tell them the news. According to Suetonius, Otho essentially told the senators, "Hey, the people are calling for me to be the new emperor. I don't know about all that, but well, I guess we better listen to them. And so Otho became the 7th emperor of Rome. As he had once been Nero's friend, and because the general public of Rome actually kind of liked the deceased emperor, statues to Nero that had been toppled were re-erected within the city. People even began referring to Otho as Nero Otho. While he reluctantly took the nickname in the first few days of his reign, Otho quickly decided he wanted nothing to do with the imagery of Nero and stopped the resurrection of the dead emperor's name in the empire. Also, the German legions were still very much rebelling and rallying under the banner of Vitellius. Otho had been very gung-ho with his treason against Galba when he viewed the northern rebels as a simple thorn in the side of the imperial throne. However, now that he was actually the emperor and could read through the war correspondences, Otho realized that Vitellius's troops were an actual problem that could topple his regime. He then came up with a decision to attempt to parley with Vitellius, but the two men's back and forth dissolved into arguments, further exacerbating the war effort on both sides. In April, Otho decided to go into full-on war mode, gathering up the legions loyal to him. Unfortunately, the provinces further from Italy were unwilling to lend a hand, meaning Otho had to immediately rely on the Italian legions while accepting the future backup from Eastern European legions. And by this point, Vitellius's German legions were basically already on Italy's doorstep. Otho stayed south of the Po River, which is the longest river in Italy in its northern section, while his troops marched north to meet Vitellius. The latter's army proved to be too powerful, forcing Otho's troops to retreat. When word reached the emperor that Vitellius's army was victorious, he resolved to commit suicide rather than be taken as a prisoner. So, on the 16th of April, Otho stabbed himself in the heart. He had only been emperor for 91 days, the shortest reign in Roman history for the next 130 years. The third emperor in the year of four emperors was, hopefully unsurprisingly, Vitellius. Yes, the German proconsul's rebellion proved to be victorious. He approached the Senate after his victory over Otho and was recognized as the new leader of Rome on the 19th of April. Unlike the previous leaders of Rome, Vitellius chose to forego the title of Caesar, instead adding the name Germanicus to his title, therefore making him Aulus Vitellius Germanicus Imperator Augustus, showing his power arising from the German legions, and possibly also calling back to the great war hero Germanicus, the father of Emperor Gaius Germanicus and brother of Claudius. And you know the deal, now it's time to look at Vitellius's past. Now, here's an interesting fact about my research into Vitellius. The only primary source we have over his life before his rebellion against Galba and Otho is from Suetonius. Suetonius's father served in Otho's army, and the historian kinda outright admits that he's biased against Vitellius due to this. Anyways, the Vitellii family's origins are vague, and two different stories were told about them during Vitellius's life. The first story is that they were absolute nobodies who eventually became part of the equestrian social class. The other story is that the Vitellii were descended from the leaders of old Latium, Latium being the general region of western Italy where Rome was eventually founded, making the Vitellii ancestors leaders of the tribes who would eventually become the Romans. And though Vitellius's father would eventually be granted the senatorial rank later in his life, Vitellius was the first emperor born outside of the highest Roman social class. Otho's father had the same situation, but Vitellius's predecessor was born after the social movement. As a young man, Vitellius ended up on the island of Capri under the household of Emperor Tiberius. Now, if you didn't listen to the Tiberius episodes, he kinda just semi-retired from being emperor and moved to Capri to live a very private life. This life was also said to be full of moral degradation, with orgies and killing abound. It was during this time that Vitellius would have become friends with Gaius Germanicus, and the two would bond over their shared love of chariot racing and gambling. Vitellius was elected as one of the consuls for the year 48 CE, and he would have been 32 years old at this time. As he had been friends with Gaius Germanicus, Vitellius was also able to become close with Nero due to the same reasons. In fact, he was chosen by Nero to help preside over the Neronian Games, Nero's version of the Olympics that included some more artistic endeavors than the original games. Nero made Vitellius proconsul of Roman Africa in 60 CE. He was a good proconsul, but Suetonius notes that he was prone to stealing from temples and counterfeiting relics from them, using tin and brass instead of silver and gold. In 68, when Galba took over from Nero, he was made the commander of the legions in Germania Inferior, which is actually more in line with the modern-day nations of Belgium and the Netherlands than Germany itself. Suetonius says this was done out of spite rather than an actual honor, because Vitellius was forced to sell all of his wealth in order to afford to move to his new job. The Germanic legions were already growing dismissive towards Galba, so a man who was not in his favor being sent to be their leader was actually a blessing for the soldiers. On top of that, Vitellius had purposely been kind to everyone along the way so he could win their favor. Unsurprisingly, a month into his new job as commander, the legions took it upon themselves to name Vitellius their new emperor. And we all know how things went from there. Vitellius started his reign by punishing the army of Otho. This forced many soldiers to save their necks by announcing that, actually, they had been planning on betraying the former emperor all along, so Vitellius stopped killing his former enemies. His friendship with Nero was also celebrated by the Roman public. Unlike Otho, who started resenting this fact, Vitellius welcomed the popularity, even going as far as to have songs written by Emperor Nero performed in public. Vitellius was even given praise for opening up more government positions to members of the equestrian social class, which makes sense given his familial background. On a weird note, Vitellius would go on to outlaw astrologers from Rome, and yes, astrologers, not astronomers. This would seem to be, at least to me, due to his relative bad luck with astrology readings and prophetic readings. Apparently, when he was born, his horoscope was so bad that his parents thought he would never amount to anything good. But again, this is Suetonius writing about a guy he hated. Also, apparently there was a prophecy that he would not have a long reign if his mother lived, so Vitellius had her killed. Well, we're only three emperors into the year of four emperors, so we'll see how that goes, my guy. Unsurprisingly, not everyone was excited to have Vitellius as the new emperor. Just as the Germanic legions had rebelled under Galba and Otho, the legions in the furthest eastern provinces of the empire began to rebel. And just like before, they named their commander as the new emperor. His name was Titus Flavius Vespasianus, more commonly known as Vespasian. Spoiler alert, we'll learn more about him later. Though I will say that his name has actually come up before in one of the Nero episodes due to his involvement with the Jewish-Roman War. Vitellius put several legions of soldiers under the command of a man named Caecina, who had been a general in Germania who helped him gain the throne. Unfortunately, Caecina had come to realize that he didn't like Vitellius as emperor and defected to join Vespasian's army. This blindsided many, including the emperor and his armies. As a result, the loyal legions lost their first battle against Vespasian. When Vitellius put his troops under the command of a new leader, that guy was then captured and executed. So, seeing as he was fairly outmatched by this new upstart from the east, Vitellius recognized the writing on the wall and decided it would probably be best if he just abdicated the throne. Unfortunately, the Praetorian Guard wouldn't let him. So Vitellius was powerless as Vespasian's army marched on Rome. The public who still supported the emperor decided to fight back, which resulted in many deaths on both sides. Unfortunately, there were citizens in Rome who wanted Vespasian to be emperor, and they stormed the palace to find Vitellius. They dragged him out of his palace and had him killed. Suetonius writes that he was beaten to death. Historian Cassius Dio says he was beheaded by the crowd. Either way, the third emperor of the year was struck down on the 20th of December, meaning he ruled for 8 months. But we've still got a few days left in the year, and that means there's one more emperor we have to cover. In what I'm sure is a massive surprise, Vespasian was crowned as the new emperor of Rome. And I'll say up front that I want this episode to really only cover the year of the four emperors. Vespasian would go on to rule for a decade, so clearly I'm not going to cover most of his rule here, otherwise we'd only be about halfway through the episode and I don't want that. And also, if I really want to be technical about things, Vespasian's coronation would not be until the 1st of January in 70 CE, meaning he wasn't the emperor during this past tumultuous year. Vespasian was born in November of 9 CE to an equestrian class family. His father was a tax collector and his mother's family had held a couple important ranks in the army and government. Vespasian's older brother had become a military commander with power along the Danube River. In order to get his hopeful future in politics underway, Vespasian joined the military around 27 CE, serving in the region of Thrace, along the border of Greece and Turkey. After 3 years of service, the future emperor received a position in the public works department of the government in charge of street cleaning. Yep, the future great emperor of Rome spent his early adult life cleaning garbage off the roads. And apparently he wasn't that great at this position. There's a story that Gaius Germanicus was so unimpressed with Vespasian's duties that he grabbed a handful of mud and stuffed it down the latter's toga. When he was finally elected into a political position, his family's low standing meant that he was given a quaestorship on the island of Crete rather than in Rome itself. Under Emperor Claudius in the 40s CE, Vespasian was able to prove himself in the military. While originally stationed in Germania, he was chosen to join the legions in the subjugation of Britannia. He was given the role of conquering the southwestern portion of the island, mainly to gain control of tin in Cornwall and silver in Somerset. Vespasian also conquered the Isle of Wight and set up a Roman fort that would eventually become the city of Exeter. Due to this success, he was awarded a military triumph. In the 50s CE, Vespasian's luck turned when he ran afoul of Empress Agrippina, the wife of Claudius and mother to Emperor Nero. He briefly retired from politics until Nero made him governor of Roman Africa in 63 CE. Being proconsul of Africa was usually a get-rich scheme as it was a stable source of income and food for the empire. However, Vespasian chose to use his influence to gather allies at the cost of getting rich, and he was forced to mortgage his house during this time. And depending on which historian you read about, I guess depending on how they viewed his rule, his governing of Africa is either viewed as tyrannical or honorable. After his stint in Africa, Vespasian was brought into Nero's retinue as the emperor paraded around Greece. Unfortunately, he fell asleep during one of the emperor's lyre concerts and was forced into serving in the far eastern provinces of the empire. This coincided with growing unrest in the province of Judea, as the local Jewish population was being suppressed by Nero's choice of governor. When the unrest broke out into a full-scale war, the Roman-Jewish War, Vespasian was chosen to lead the Roman military. At this point, we get a clearer picture of Vespasian from the Roman-Jewish historian Josephus, who actually originally fought against Vespasian in the war before being captured and made the future emperor's slave. Maybe due to this status and wanting to appease his master, Josephus wrote that Vespasian was a man of great honor during the war, compared with the wicked King Herod Agrippa, who despite being Jewish was very much on Rome's side. But despite being written as honorable, this didn't stop Josephus from writing about how Vespasian destroyed the city of Jericho in 68 CE and drowned many Jews in the Dead Sea, apparently trying to test the buoyancy level of that body of water. Fun fact, the Dead Sea's super high salt levels make it near impossible to sink in, So clearly Vespasian was doing some messed up stuff here. Josephus also wrote about how a prophecy alleged that when the Second Temple in Jerusalem and the land of Judea fell, the Messiah would come about to rule the world. He interpreted Vespasian's might and eventual rise to emperor as a sign that he was the prophesied Messiah. He laments that the general public was not as willing to believe this. From there, we get into the year of the four emperors. With the growing unrest and constant change in government, the Eastern legions decided to name their great military leader as the new head of Rome. So, leaving his son Titus in charge of the forces in the Roman-Jewish War, Vespasian set out for Rome to receive his new destiny. With Vitellius dead, the Senate recognized Vespasian as emperor on the 21st of December, though, as I said, his coronation wouldn't be until New Year's Day. Now, you'd think with all the strife, surely someone would rise up to challenge Vespasian, but no one was ever able to become a serious contender to the throne. So, with a fourth man on the throne in 1 year, Rome was finally able to settle into peace. And actually, Vespasian wasn't even in Rome until halfway through his first year as emperor. Yeah, his army had successfully captured the empire's capital, but the guy himself was in Egypt when the Senate proclaimed him to be the next ruler. In his place, his other son, Domitian, and an ally named Mucianus helped set the stage for his imperial ascension. This mostly involved tax reforms, including a tax reform on the collection of urine. This sounds really weird until you learn that urine, specifically the compound ammonia in said fluid, was used in the production of a lot of Rome's cleaning processes. It was even used in the production of Roman currency. When Vespasian finally returned to Rome, he came home to a nation that was being put back together. His son Titus was finishing up the Roman-Jewish War, which resulted in the destruction of the Second Temple of Jerusalem, remembered by the Jewish fasting day of Tisha B'Av, and other military leaders were suppressing an uprising in Gaul. As per usual, his enemies were dismissed or killed and his allies were elevated to influential positions. Propaganda campaigns were launched to establish his rule. All in all, things went very smoothly. Things went so smoothly that Vespasian became the first Roman emperor to have his biological son succeed him, namely Emperor Titus, and the Flavian dynasty, named after Vespasian's family name Flavius, managed to rule Rome for the next 27 years. But for now, that's it for this week's episode of Royally Screwed. I hope you enjoyed the journey. Be sure to subscribe to the show and tell a friend all about it. As per usual, the show is going on its mandatory 1 month break. In the meantime, be sure to rate the show on whatever platform you use in order to help others find it. When the show returns, we're heading to Japan to talk about Japanese samurai. In the late period of the shoguns ruling over Japan, there existed an organization called the Shinsengumi. Let's learn about their leadership as the land of the rising sun undergoes a massive change in its political landscape. I hope you'll join me then for another topsy-turvy look into history's most interesting rulers.